Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording this on Friday, January 24th, 2020, which is the day that the very first set of the Disney Short Circuit films become available for viewing on Disney Plus. Now, Drew, you went over to Walt Disney Animation Studios earlier this month and got to sit down with a bunch of the folks who actually made these movies, right? Or?
Yes. It was a great day. Any day at Walt Disney Animation Studios is a great day, Jim, but this was really great.
I have to say I envy that you got to see these in the screening room there at Disney, because there's at least a couple of these that I would love to see on the big screen.
Yeah, it was also nice that they were all together. They had little, I don't know, if, are there little like filmmaker intros on
there are,
Disney
there
Plus?
Are. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they showed those intros and then they just ran the movies. So it was really great because, you know, it was uninterrupted. You couldn't look at your phone. You couldn't, you know, be distracted by Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it was just a really nice way to see them. So I'm curious. I want to know what your favorites were.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in the second half on today's show. But first, let's plow into the news here. And to start things off, we need to do a shout-out to Bill Farmer and his lovely wife, Jennifer. Yesterday was the 33rd anniversary of Bill being hired by Disney's character voice department to become the official voice of Goofy. The very first time that Farmer voiced this character was back in 1987. It was for a holiday special that you can actually watch on YouTube right now, Drew. It's Disney's DTV Doggone Valentine, which aired, I guess, on February 13th of that year. And
what the hell is DTV?
Oh, God. See, you know, I know you've seen these, but your brain has protected you, Drew. It's selectively forgotten. This was when Disney, in a desperate effort to appear cool and hip, you know, took old shows.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I now you're triggering me, but yes.
There we go.
See?
And that's the appropriate word, trigger, because these things are. I was watching just a little bit of them, and it's like, oh, I forgot about this.
They were music videos that there were characters over.
Oh, yeah.
Overlaid, right?
Yeah. It was just, it was bad stuff. But again, it got Bill employed. And actually, what's kind of cool is that Bill isn't just a Disney legend, he's also a Disney nerd. So, how does he choose to celebrate his 33rd year working for Disney? He goes to Club 33 with his wife. So,
you know, if only other members of this podcast could go to Club 33 with their wives, Jim. I'm just saying.
I'm just
putting that out there.
We'll
Jim.
Have a conversation after we finish the show. Okay. I owe you and Katie a wedding present anyway. So, okay. And speaking of things that got tweeted out last week, did you see that tweet Josh Gad put up about his new animated series, Central Park?
No, I did not see that.
Okay. He said to this effect, "Cannot wait for you all to see this incredible new series this summer. It's one of the most special things I've ever been a part of. Hashtag Central Park." Little background here. This is a new animated comedy from Lauren Bouchard, who's the creator of Bob's Burgers. It's being animated by Bento Box Entertainment, which I think you've talked about on previous shows, Drew.
Yeah, it's very close to where I live, actually.
Is it really?
On Lake Rishim. Yeah, in North Hollywood. Yeah, they're up there. Yeah.
Okay. And this is supposed to begin streaming on Apple TV Plus starting later this summer. And premise of the show is, let's see, it involves a family of caretakers who live and work in Central Park, who wind up saving the park and basically the world. And, I mean, that's literally the log line of the show. And what's kind of interesting is that evidently Apple TV landed the rights for this show in a very competitive situation back in March of 2018. And they believe strongly enough in the show, they ordered two seasons right up front. So, going to be kind of interesting, you know, and again, I always enjoy Josh when he does animations, and as a big fan of Bob's Burgers, you know, can't wait to see this show.
Yeah, I think it has sort of a sci-fi tinge to it or something.
Cool.
Did you see him on Conan talking about how he visited the set of Rise of Skywalker on the day where Palpatine says to Rey, "You are my granddaughter"?
No.
And he said,
"Oh, Oh, no. Okay. And?
Pretty funny. He said he was so annoyed because he wanted to, you know, it was very cool being on the set, but he wanted to, you know, he wanted to experience that in the theater. And then he had to keep his mouth shut for a year or whatever. So,
jeez.
Thought that was pretty funny.
That is
pretty
funny.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we were talking about shows getting picked up by streaming services. I don't know if you saw the news coming out of Hulu last week that they've picked up three shows from DreamWorks Animation.
I did see that.
You know, well, first we've got Madagascar A Little Wild, which is what? Just basically the Muppet Babies version of this franchise. Alex the Lion, Marty the Zebra and company, but it's little kids.
Yeah, I don't like that because I don't want them being happy in the zoo. I don't like zoos, and I don't want them to be happy in the zoo. The whole point of Madagascar was that they got out of the zoo. That seems a little bit problematic to me, but okay. That might just be my, you know, animal rights side kicking
no,
in.
No. That's a valid point. on the other hand, we have, what, Trollstopia, which, as I understand it, builds off of the Trolls World Tour movie, which comes out on April 17th of this year. And then there's the Mighty Ones. Have you heard about this one?
No.
Okay. It's a animated adventure series set in your average backyard that features a twig, a pebble, a leaf, and a strawberry. So picture this, Drew. In a month's time, Toy Fair kicks off at the Jacob Javits Center in New York. You and I both know, you know, the guys from Hasbro and Mattel are going to be duking it out in the aisles for the rights for the show that stars the Pebble and the Twig. So,
listen, if Pickle and Peanut was a show on Disney Channel, then, well, you know.
It's so funny you say that, because, again, think about it. Back in 1999, somebody from Viacom had to have the exact same conversation with toy manufacturers for SpongeBob. Think about it. You're in that pitch, and, well, it stars a sponge who has a pet snail called Gary, and his best friend is a sea star. And it's like, and you know there's some toy company executive who's developed a very serious drinking problem because he's the guy who said, that sounds like the stupidest show. You know, I mean, there's no way we're licensing, you know, SpongeBob.
Right. Well, do you think it's weird that these shows aren't on Peacock? Because DreamWorks Animation is now a part of Universal.
Yeah, you know, but the weird part of it is that it takes a while to tap the brakes in Hollywood, and DreamWorks Animation was just making deals left and right to sort of keep the lights on.
That's true.
You know,
and I mean, there's a lot of stuff on Netflix. Have you watched Kipo and the Wonder Beasts yet?
No. And in fact, that they had I don't know if you saw this video that DreamWorks Animation put up within the past month or so, but it basically was a tribute to the past 20 years of their television animation operation. And it was all of these recreations of figures of their central characters from their franchises, but done in domino format. And it's like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it honestly was. It was a unique way to sort of acknowledge the anniversary. And at the same time, what was interesting is that the Spirit television show was in there, and Troll Hunters and the like. I don't think Kipo made the list, though. So,
speaking of Troll Hunters, where the hell is Wizards? We need it. We need the third chapter, Jim.
I do not know what to tell you, you know. But again, oddly enough, you know, that brings up my quote for the day, which, you know, again, famous William Goldman quote: when it comes to Hollywood, nobody knows anything. You know, mm-hmm. And I especially bring that up on the heels of the news coming out of Sundance Animation last week, or excuse me, Skydance. Alessandro Carlani walked away from Luck, you know, for that famous coverall excuse, creative differences. And so normally that, you know, the way Hollywood operates, you know, director walks away from a film, you know, that's a bad thing. But did you see who they've hired to replace him?
Yes, I think that is a great choice, yeah, to replace him.
This is, of course, Peggy Holmes. And I, in your time at Disney, did you have any dealings with Peggy? Or,
well, by the time I got to Disney, Toon Studio was kind of, mm-hmm, on the back burner. But I mean, I did the press days for all the fairies and movies like that. So yeah, she's great.
Oh yeah. Well, Peggy's smart woman, passionate storyteller. And what I love about her is she can take a teeny tiny budget and stretch it further than anybody on the planet. I mean, that's the thing of those Walt Disney home premiere films is they always looked great on very little money. So, you know, in a weird sort of way, Skydance Animation is very lucky to have landed Peggy to be the new director of Luck.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, all right, the premise of this animated film is Luck is a comedy that pulls back the curtain on the millennia-old battle between the organization of good luck and bad luck that secretly affects our daily lives. Though that said, we haven't talked lately about Mr. Lasseter, who's over there is...
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, yeah.
And now, again, his role, it's creative advisor, it's what exactly...
I've never gotten a clear answer as to what his day-to-day actually is. I just think it's very interesting that they hire a woman from the fairies, and all those reports came out about Lasseter getting very handsy with the actors that were playing the fairies. Remember that?
Oh God, that story slipped my mind. Again, it's I probably kept it in the same box as the DTV videos. All right, you know, just sort of right. That just got interesting.
Yeah. So okay, that'll be an interesting press tour, is what I'm saying.
There we go. All right. Wow. Okay. There's another event we're not getting invited to, Drew. And speaking of somebody who, it's not a question of invite. He's actually more to the effect of excused himself out. You know, Hank Azaria just last week in an interview with Slash Film said straight out, "I won't be doing the voice of Apu anymore," which is kind of interesting. You know, we had that documentary back in 2017, The Trouble with Apu, The Problem with Apu. Did you ever get to see that? Or
I never saw it. No, is it great?
They do an interesting job. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I have my South Asian sister-in-law, and I got talking with her about this very same issue, you know, to the effect of, do you find Apu offensive? Because, again, you got to remember, when the show first came on the air, he was the first Indian character that really showed up in network television. Again, of course, this is Fox back in its early days. This was early, early, early for Fox. So, but The Simpsons was one of their first hits right out of the gate, and Apu was, you know, was part of the ensemble almost from, episode 2, episode 3?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, the weird part of it is that they acknowledge this in an episode last season. You know, they had, I forget the quote that Lisa used, but it was just, you know, the notion that the world has kind of moved on and it's time to change. And so, you know, you have to applaud them, you know, for, okay, we're finally going to do this. And more to the point, it's not like Hank, who voices, 10 other characters on the show, is going to be hurting for work. But
yeah, I mean, I kind of have two lines of thought about it. One is like, yeah, this is probably overdue.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's like, it's been going on for 30-something years, so, you know, making kind of a stink about it now seems sort of weird. But, you know, I don't know. How do you feel about it, Jim?
Well, I'm actually more intrigued at this point. Is it Tress McNeil who voices Apu's wife? You know,
it's Jan Hooks.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could. Okay. Is it just Hank who has to step away, or is it Jan as well? I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess there's more questions to ask at this point. And, speaking of animation that's related to Fox, or used to be related to Fox, I wish we had better news about Spies in Disguise, but that Blue Sky Studios movie, in fact, it basically came out a month ago today. I mean, it was released to theaters December 25th. But it's really kind of run out of gas. $60 million worth of tickets sold stateside, $76 million overseas. Total worldwide box office at this point, $136 million. And we're not seeing a new Blue Sky movie till 2022?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess what's strange for me is, you think about it, $136 million sounds like a large amount of money. But then, what was it, just last week we had the news of the Seth MacFarlane deal with NBC Universal, the $200 million deal. Right.
Well, I was going to say, also $136 million, if you spread it out over a production that lasted seemingly forever, between the delays and the new animation and the new voice cast that they crammed in there at the last minute. I'm sure that this thing cost a huge amount of money when all was said and done.
And the weird part of it is, I finally got serious about, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to see this thing. And it's nowhere. I can't find it anywhere in theaters here up in New Hampshire. And that's, you know, not even that token matinee they sometimes do for family films. So it's just kind of heartbreaking.
I did see Aladdin. I saw Adam's Family this week.
And?
Finally.
And?
It's fine. I still think the animation is terrible. Mm-hmm. And the designs are really, really, really bad. But it's fine. You know, it's a cute story. I just wish that the animation had been a little bit more sophisticated and the design work had been better. I don't know. I think there would have been a way to translate those drawings into 3D computer animation in a more aesthetically pleasing way, let's say.
It'll obviously, we have a sequel on the way. It'll be kind of interesting to see, you know, what the decision is, you know, to the effect of, you know how they work in animation. It's the notion of, you have a rig, you used it. You actually used it to make that movie. Oh, no. We have new tools. We need to build a new rig. You know, you think you already had pre-existing assets that are going to hit the ground running on a project like that. And it's like, no. It's time to spend even more money.
Right. I just want to see the Tim Burton stop-motion version that he was going to do for Illumination.
Oh, you are killing me.
Remember that, Jim?
Yeah. Well, also, what was it? The Henry Selick Shadow Project? Every yes. So often, some imagery from that bubbles up online, and that's another heartbreaker. But on the other hand, we got to celebrate the fact that every so often, good stuff happens. Like just this last week, we got news that we've got a Tex Avery Blu-ray coming out. Tex Avery Screwball Classics Volume 1. And again, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be a jerk, but I immediately said, oh, cool, I'm going to get to see my favorite Tex Avery film again, which is Magical Maestro from 1952, and nope.
Yeah.
The 13 or 16 shorts, I mean, don't get me wrong, they've got a bunch of screwy squirrels and droopy. It's 138 minutes of Tex Avery goodness, though I don't know if... Do you pay attention to Mark Evanier's News For Me website?
No, what is that?
Oh, he's a wonderful animation writer. He's worked for years and has all of these great show business stories. But he told this great story recently about how he actually went with a bunch of his friends and Tex when Tex was still alive to see sort of a festival of Texas shorts. And said what was interesting is about three or four films in, people began to gravitate to the lobby. They actually found Tex sitting out there. And Tex kind of smiled and said, you know, you got to understand, these were never intended to be shown back to back to back, you know, because they're so crazy. You know, they're so high energy that it's the equivalent of somebody singing loudly and screaming in your face for 7 minutes at a time. And it just, you know, 28 minutes in, it's like, all right, I got to go out to the lobby. You know, I need to smoke or whatever. So,
yeah. Well, I was going to say that there's really no rhyme or reason to the sequencing of this Blu-ray or the ones that they chose, because it's not like they're not even in chronological order, really. I don't know. It's very weird. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm very happy that this Blu-ray exists and I'll be, you know, getting it But
no, absolutely. And again, it's volume one. So in theory, this one sells. We get a volume two and Magical Maestro will eventually show up. Honestly, it's weird to watch that one on television or on your computer, that sort of thing, because it has one gag that is only Tex could have come up with. Have you seen this one? It's the one where the
I don't know if I have.
Okay, so it's basically a guy on stage singing. And what happens is in the lower left-hand corner, you suddenly see a hair show up. Like it's a real projector, like a hair is shown up on the projector and then it disappears. And then, you know, maybe 10 seconds later, it comes back and the character is singing and then finally stops singing, walks over to the hair, pulls it out, you know, and sort of throws it off the screen and then comes back to center stage and starts singing again. It's this wonderful breaking the fourth wall moment that, again, only Tex and you know, his crew at MGM could have ever come up with. Kind of interesting that, again, that we're talking about, you know, shorts that were made back in the 40s and the 50s, because after this break, we're going to talk about the Disney short circuit program.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Okay, so before we get started here, the Disney Short Circuit program was basically created for Disney Plus, right?
Yeah. No, Short Circuit was never intended for outside screening. Like, all the animators were like, we thought no one would ever see this stuff.
Wow.
So I guess at some point, you know, Disney Plus came to Disney Animation. They said, we have this new platform. Do you have anything? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we've got these shorts. I mean, most of them are, you know, upwards of 3 years old.
Are they really?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Well, I have to admit, I was intrigued by the length. I mean, some of them, typically, what is it, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, and out, yeah. Right?
Or... yeah. I think 90 seconds was what everyone was gunning for. Mm-hmm. Some of them went a little over, some of them went a little under.
Okay.
But yeah, they never thought these would be shown. I mean, what's interesting is that there have been, I think there were three kind of like classes mm-hmm. of shorts. So the second class kind of learned from what the people did in the first class and so on and so forth. They were also borrowing assets and stuff from each other, which is really interesting.
Well, like, I wanted to bring that up. For example, The Race has crazy hyper-detailed backgrounds. Is mm-hmm. that one of the films that borrowed assets?
I'm not sure. It was more like characters and stuff. The toupee short was the very first one mm-hmm. that was made, and they actually made characters for that. And then apparently those characters show up in every other short when they're like people that are needed.
Oh.
And like Baby Moana is in the one about the raindrop.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's really interesting. Like, you know, a lot of the fish and stuff at the end of the puddle mm-hmm. one are from Moana. So it's really interesting that they kind of borrowed stuff from movies that were in production or assets they had available and changed them around and, put them in these shorts, but it is really a feat of ingenuity and creativity, I think. But yeah,
absolutely. Wow. But again, there's sort of differentiate here. So this is an in-house program and Disney Plus comes along and is able to repurpose these films that were done in-house. Now, is that the same case with Forky Asks the Question?
I think Forky Asks the Question. Did you not read my great Bob Peterson profile, Jim? You think you have an ally on your side, somebody you know you'll get that click out of, but I guess not. But anyway, right. I did a very long, mm-hmm. detailed profile of Bob Peterson,
okay.
And he is one, the nicest man in the world.
Oh,
obviously.
Yeah.
And two, I think, from what I understood, that the shorts started, basically they said, like, do you have anything that you can put on Disney Plus? But Pixar could only make about 30 minutes of content.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't do a show because it would be one show and it would be over.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to really stretch the 30 minutes and make 10 of these little shorts. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. And we also have a new Pixar short next week called Lamp Life, which I've seen, which is also very awesome. And is about Bo's time in between
getting sold.
And, you'll appreciate another fine Jim Hanks performance, Jim, for you.
Well, you know,
couldn't bring Tom back for 5 minutes, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, the Tom Hanks brothers got to eat too. To get back to Forky asked a question. So four more have dropped since we last talked about this series, and I wanted to say of them, the What Is Cheese one is a standout. I don't know if you've seen this, but it brings Jeff Garland back as the voice of Buttercup, the plush unicorn, and he basically speed learns a Forky, and they cover everything from Lincoln was a good president to string theory, and not string cheese theory, but like literally the unifying, you know, field theory.
Yes, but you have to also say that in this lesson, it's accompanied by the most sort of like educational 80s show graphics and old JPEGs of stars exploding and things.
No, which, you're right. I mean, that's half the charm of it. On the other hand, another, and again, before we swing back to the Disney Short Circuit stuff, Pixar also has its own Spark Shorts program. Mm-hmm. Two shorts dropped. First, we have Loop, which is written and directed by Erica Milson. And I think you were talking about this is, Pixar's first nonverbal character?
Yeah, I think it's like nonverbal, you know, of speaking age, but not speaking. Okay. So, yeah. Which is, I thought it was really great.
I agree. For me, it was surprisingly brave in a lot of ways. First of all, there's not a whole lot of story. It really is kind of a, you know, slice of life kind of a thing. Also, you know, they really lean into this autistic character. It's a very realistic portrayal, and they don't pull a lot of punches. It's one of those things where it's like, wow, congrats for doing something like that. On the other hand,
we should also note that the Spark Shorts are really long.
Yeah. In fact, it's interesting you brought that up because the next one that I just tripped over earlier today, Wind has been out there since December 13th of last year. And it, don't get me wrong, it's a visual tour de force.
Wind is the one in the chasm.
In the chasm, yeah. And it's one of these things where it's a metaphor for the immigrant story, and it's almost 8 minutes long.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a bummer, you know, but on the other hand, there are good bummers and bad bummers. I mean, in fact, just today, and God bless him, I've been trying to see this movie for what, year and a half now, Cycles, Jeff Gibson, he's Disney's first VR short, but this is now finally available for viewing on Disney Plus. And I know you've talked about this previously on the show. And in fact, I think we actually had an interview with Jeff that you did featured on an earlier episode. And to finally get to see this film you've described and even going into it knowing as much as I did and to have it land that hard with that strong a punch.
It's beautiful, right?
It's beautiful. And, you know, and I love that final grace note, you know, to the effect of what, the daughter asking the mom, you know, you're going to miss your house, mom? And it's like, no, I'm going to miss my home. And, you know, I mean,
and it also has that great, the very last shot of the house, like destroyed with like, you know, spray paint and graffiti and stuff. It was like, ugh.
Yeah.
It's gutting. But I think Jeff is actually like one of the most talented young animators. I mean, this guy looks like he just graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. He's got this kind of like, he's kind of a kind of poet skateboarder is how I kind of, you know, he's like, he's very spiritual, but he also, you know, he's kind of a cool Southern California guy, you know? So he, and I loved Myth a lot too.
I was about to say, that he just did the second VR thing for the studio, that Myth, A Frozen Tale. And I want to know when that's going to show up, because if Cycles is as good, And I've heard people raving about Myth. You know that
Myth is amazing. It's amazing.
And it supposedly actually does, what, almost a better job of setting the stage for Frozen 2 than the film itself does, right? Or
yes. I still don't know what happened in Frozen 2. But I know a little bit more now. But yeah. I mean, talk about a guy who also, like, you know, make yourself indispensable is always a good rule of thumb at any job, right? And he's like, I'm the VR guy. And they're like, okay, let's do it. And they're just beautiful. And I love that last time I was at Animation, he was literally setting up a VR headset for somebody to come watch Myth. It's like, this guy can do it all. He can set up his own movie. You know, you put on the goggle. I mean, it was really great to see. He is just the best.
I know. Was this during the Disney Short Circuit press day? Or
yeah, it was. But we didn't do that. We didn't do Myth on that day. I think there was just somebody who wanted to see it. And so he ran over there and set it up, which is pretty great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, can we talk a little bit about the individual films here?
Let's go through them, Jim.
Okay. Well, first and foremost, John Aquino's Lightning in a Bottle. Mm-hmm. I chose this one because the interesting thing is the introduction.
Are these your favorites, Jim?
Well, I'm going to be kind of random here. Pick this one to start because John mentioned how much he loved the Spielberg movies, you know, when he was growing up. And this is very Spielberg-y.
Yes.
You know, in fact, you know, as I was watching this, I couldn't help but think, we just talked about Apple TV Plus. They're rebooting Amazing Stories. In fact, we just got a start date for the reboot, March 6th. And I was watching this and it's like I was really hoping that, you know, again, not that we want anybody poaching talent from Disney. Didn't Brad Bird basically start his career by doing that animated episode of Amazing Stories, Family Dog?
Yes, and he co-wrote that one about the kid who has magnetism, head of the class. Do you remember that one?
Oh, God, yes.
And then Batteries Not Included started out as a episode of Amazing Stories.
Wow.
This will all be in my Brad Bird biography coming next year from... that's where he got his start. I mean, a lot of really talented people got their start on that show. There is nothing that makes me feel like I'm 10 again than putting on Amazing Stories. Do you remember when they would package them as movies and show them sort of in the afternoon syndicated?
Yeah.
I
have to say that had my favorite opening of a show in the 80s, you know, and that was John Williams' music, right?
Yeah, I love that theme. The only one that topped it a few years later was the Jim Henson Hour. I love that opening too.
Yeah,
really beautiful. You know. Anyway, we're getting off topic.
Okay.
Yes.
Next up is Brian Estrada's Hair Jitsu, which I have to admit, I liked more than you did.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was a beautifully staged story of little girl's first haircut that suddenly take a hard left and becomes this crazy over-the-top kung fu film. I love the tag gag at the end, but I think in a lot of cases, a number of these films rise and fall on the fact that, again, they've only got 90 seconds to tell their stories. In the case of something like Brian Scott's Elephant in the Room, I honestly, if that film had even a minute, 2 minutes more to tell its story, I think it could have landed a little better. What would your take on those?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on Elephant in the Room. I thought Elephant in the Room looked amazing. Mm-hmm. It was, like, so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I love elephants, obviously, as you just heard of my rant against zoos. But, you know, yeah, I did think that it was a little undercooked. Not undercooked, even. It just did not have the time to expand. But, you know, I sort of seeing these together kind of made it feel like I was watching something like Fantasia. And you're going to have segments of Fantasia that you like more than other segments. And that's sort of how I feel about any kind of, like, anthology structured thing. So, you know, even the ones that I wasn't crazy about, like Hair Jitsu, I was so impressed with the style. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things we have to talk about is that each one of these looks completely different the next.
I mean, I have to admit, I wasn't necessarily all that impressed with, say, the story of Brian Menz, Just a Thought, but the fact that they leaned into the look.
I love that. That was one of my favorites, Jim.
I mean, it's cute. It really is. But for me, what was more impressive was the fact that, They really lean into that graphic look of the Sunday page, and they made it work as the story of preteen love. Now,
yeah, what kind of frustrated me about that is like everyone's praising into the Spider-Verse for doing stuff like that, and it's like Disney did it however many years ago, but nobody saw it until now. So now that's it's going to feel like it's kind of following them, but you know,
that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
It would be fascinating to find out when Brian actually did make this. On the other hand, you were just mentioning Fantasia, and which, for me, we have to talk about Jennifer Stratton's Zenith. And in fact, she talks about in her little sort of film intro that, you know, her favorite Disney film was the original Fantasia. And this thing, for me, was the most beautiful one of the bunch. In fact, this is at the point that I really, really, really envied that you got to see this in the Disney screening room, because this must have been spectacular to see in a giant screen.
Yeah. Well, first of all, that screening room has been named Matanui, which I love.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, that Zenith is definitely the most like head trip one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one that I could see projected on the ceiling of a astronomy club or something. You know, it's like it's really cool. And I love that. She said that one of the ways she pitched it was like, listen, visual effects can try out new stuff in this. Like, it can be kind of a testing ground for things that can be adopted in features later on down the line, which is sort of how I felt like Flower in the Moon. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very fun. In my roundtables, like, I asked Jerry, you know, are any of these things going to be applied to features, because you've got a movie coming out that's set in ancient China. You know, it's like,
I have to admit, you know, if you remember the original Mulan, a girl worth fighting for. And for 2 minutes that they embrace that sort of watercolor calligraphy look, and again, it's a wonderful moment in the movie. It really stands out, and I couldn't help when I was watching Jingha, you know, Flower in the Mirror, that it's this skillful mix of artistic ambition and at the same time emotional restraint, and crazy staging with, you know, all of that watercolor influence. And yeah, I mean, you know, just, you know, I couldn't help but think it's somebody who's working on Mulan has to find a way to bring Jerry in to do something for that movie. I mean, it just looked amazing. And speaking, though, of looking amazing, Kendra Vandervliet's Downtown, oh my God.
So cool. Cool short.
Yeah. It's hard, honestly, to describe this one. It's a guy who misses his bus, and basically what? A piece of graffiti helps him speed across the city. That does such a poor job of describing what an amazing, you know, the art design of this thing, the staging.
The music.
Yeah, and the fact that it's all basically done in silhouette. And, you know, I mean, somebody needs to give Kendra an action film to direct yesterday. I mean, if this is what she can do with, again, you were just mentioning the repurposed resources of Walt Disney Animation Studios. Oh, my God, what she could do with some real money and, you know, a real story.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing that we need to talk about is that almost all of the shorts utilize some form of 2D animation, not traditional hand drawn, but the comic strip one, this one. And she talked about how they kind of created 3D characters and kind of smashed them flat.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you watch this movie, it's about somebody who is sort of interacting with street art, and the way that works is really, I thought, very, very striking, and never hit a bad note. I mean, it never looked like a video game. It was just so unique.
Absolutely. You know, if this is her portfolio pieces, you know, that's Kendra's going places. On the other hand, to bury the needle in the exact opposite direction, Mitch Council's Fetch, you know, the fact that this was set in, you know, what, the primeval forest with a cute little girl, but there wasn't a misplaced detail in it. I mean, I loved, for example, how they established the boundary of, you know, the deep, dark forest with that group of stones that had been set in the ground, and how the little girl just strides fearlessly over those. And the moss, the trees, a wonderful setting, and then to have the story take the turn that it did. Yeah.
I thought that was actually one of the only ones that looks like sort of traditional Walt Disney Animation Studios right now. And
yeah,
I thought they should have put it in front of Frozen 2, for God's sakes. I mean, I thought that one was like, that one's ready to go out the door, like very commercial, but very entertaining. And you're right, beautifully told. I mean, and the kind of character is, I won't say who it is, but I thought that design was just beautiful.
At the same time, if I had to pick my favorite out of this bunch, it would probably be Zach Parrish's Puddles.
Love it.
You know, which again, just hugely imaginatively, wonderfully staged. And certainly doesn't hurt that it had a terrific payoff. And I don't want to say too much. I want people to literally just finish listening to the podcast, get on Disney Plus and watch that. Because, again, I think that one was so well self-contained, just like with Fetch. You could have dropped that in front of, you know, the next Disney animated feature, and that would have been, you know. After that, Natalie Nourigate's, you know, exchange student had some interesting story beats. I liked Trent Corey's drop, you know, how it blended CG and hand-drawn animation. Me personally, it was great to see Dan Lund back in action again. And I think we talked about the race, you know, that again had amazing backgrounds and some interesting story beats. I guess if I had to pick the one that really didn't work all that well for me, that would be Lucky Toupee, which I think you were talking about, that was the very first one.
Yes, that was the very first one they produced, and I agree that it's not the best, but I also give it some, like I was saying, the other animators relied on the animators that came before them to help with their shorts. The other thing that we should mention is, like, the hair jujitsu, that was done by a guy who was, like a PA. Like, these shorts could come from anywhere in the studio, which I think is very inspiring. Story artist, background artist, you know, concept designer. Like, the whole gamut of Walt Disney Animation Studios is represented in these shorts. And I think that's really inspiring. But the point is that Nikki didn't have anybody to go to. You know, she was on her own.
And let's be completely honest here. The artificial setup that these are 90-second long shorts. When I was watching this thing, and you know, watched it a couple times before, you know, kind of trying to settle on how I felt about it. It basically, this is kind of a prep and landing secret world story, and you really need to do exposition with these. You really need to do place setting for the world, and that's a thing. It's just sort of like, if you had to tell the story of prep and landing in 90 seconds, you wouldn't get all the great juice, and it's just a thing.
Right. Well, like in her intro, she's like, they're little gangsters.
And yeah, I love that setup.
Yeah.
And it took me wrong. There's wonderful, you know, physical comedy bits. You know, there really is good stuff here. But it just, it kind of felt like, you know, we're in and out too quickly here. And if this thing had, if she'd had even double the length, I bet, you know, that this would have landed better. Again, it's kind of the luck of the draw. And again, when you're the first one through the door, you know, sometimes you have to plow the road for everybody else. So,
so you didn't love the race?
The race, again, I hate to say this, the backgrounds were so ridiculous, so hyper-detailed that, again, I kept going, am I looking at Arendelle? What am I looking at here? You know, and it kind of pulled me out of the movie because the death figure really is kind of generic. But again,
I liked his design, and I also... You thought it was a little dark, but I thought the amount of mayhem was pretty admirable for Disney short.
All right, that is true. For a Disney film, yes, there's a lot of off-screen chaos. So, again, folks, you're going to have to see this to understand. And
yes, closest we'll ever get to seeing Mort, I think, on the big screen.
Oh, no. Now you are killing me. That you know. Okay, so that does it for this week's fine tuning. Drew,
what, you wanted more, Jim? I go out there, I get this content for you. Jeez, you're never satisfied.
I know. I'm a terrible person. On the other hand, though, I was very pleased to see on Twitter this week all sorts of people acknowledging that they had gone out of their way to chase down Paul Hirsch's book.
And, oh, good.
Yeah, and how much they enjoyed it. And again, they bought it largely on you and I raving about it.
Right. But you talked about it with Dan, who has far less social clout than myself. But, you know, he's good. He's going to make it. He's going to get through it, you know?
Okay, so, but, you know, but again, one of the reasons that this book was on your radar, because he had done all that work on the Mission Impossible movies.
Tells great stories about them, too, in the book.
What's going on with Light the Fuse these days?
You'll appreciate this week's, Jim, if you're listening. We did a recap of two of the classic old episodes.
Oh, okay.
So taking a breather from interviews, but we've got some more people in the hopper. Mm-hmm. We're about to do a very big, deep dive on the making of Ghost Protocol. So that'll be just a really fun little series about the production of that. And we're ramping up for 100th episode. Hopefully we'll have somebody big. We're working on it. We're, you know, making the calls, sending the emails, getting some responses. See, hopefully that works out. But yeah, and then I feel like it's going to be full steam ahead because, you know, they go into production this spring.
Yeah. What was I reading? Rome? Is that where they...
Rome. Yeah. Rome is going to be a location. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna try. We're gonna try to go on set at some point.
Killing me. Okay.
Yeah. And then obviously we'll have a lot to cover with Top Gun too. There's obviously a lot of crossover there, and that's coming out in the summer. So it's gonna be a lot of stuff. It'll be we've still got a lot to talk about, Jim.
Very cool. Okay. Well, over at Jim Hill Media, we got the usual assortment of podcasts. We got Disney Dish with Len Testo. We got Marvel Us Disney, the podcast I do with Aaron Adams, the gentleman who edits a lot of the shows here. We got Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. We have I Want That with Michelle Valladolid. And we also have Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Z, who a very nice fellow. Don't believe
well,
what
Drew
has
I
to
don't
say
know.
About him. So,
I don't know. You know, I went to Galaxy's Edge for Dan last week.
Did you really?
Well, I got some great pictures from the ride opening out here and all that. So,
and does it actually deliver?
It does. I feel like it's like a masterpiece of Imagineering. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is I think this boarding group thing is crazy. Mm-hmm. And I think that it sucks that. Did you know that you can actually bypass whole sequences in the ride if certain sections aren't working?
Like, I've heard that, you know.
Yeah. So I have a friend who went on it and said, oh, my God, I didn't even see the scene that you're talking about. And it's like, oh, okay. But, yeah. It was it was a fun day. I mean, I wrote it four times, so I went on each path twice,
okay,
which was great. But, you know, it was like, since they did the big day in Florida, unless you were like a big muckety-muck, like my buddy Todd Martins at the LA Times, who wrote that great piece that you reference all the time about theme parks losing their theming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had the head of Disneyland PR walking around with him, but, you know, with me it was like, don't let the door hit you where the Lord split you. So that was more my experience, but I love the ride. I can't wait to go on it with you, Jim, when you come out here.
Okay. Well, that's hopefully that will be relatively soon. We're
good.
We're talking, folks. We have some plans for the later this spring. All right. Speaking of which, though, looking to the future, if you folks could do us a favor, both Drew and I, if you could head over to iTunes and rate and recommend not just this show, but also Light the Fuse, that helped. Gets us extra eyeballs and ears. And if you really, really, really like fine tuning, if you get head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, well, that then makes it possible to spring for the $109 tickets that, well, that's what you're paying, what, to go to next week's Disneyland After Dark, the 80s
Jim,
night.
This is what I'm doing for you then next week. I'm going to Disneyland After Dark. I'm doing Minnie's Moonlight Madness again, and I'm going to be in the top 10 this year, so help me God. And I'm going to Pixar for another Onward thing. So you're going to get a lot of content out of me next week.
Speaking of which, I wanted to tell you this. I was at Target earlier this week, and the Onward toys are on the shelf. you know, I was actually kind of surprised to see that. But I guess we are at this point. We're 6 weeks out, or?
Yeah, I mean, February 2nd or 6th will only be a month away. So, right. Yeah, it's coming up.
Okay, because I was intrigued. They've got plush toys. They've got action figures. And
yeah, I got the dad figure. I want, there's like some little ones that are vehicles, and you can get the van and you can get the bike with the little sprites driving it. So those are the ones I want to check out. So if you see those, let me know.
Okay. You know, in fact, that was why I was halfway tempted to buy the dad, was that he does come with sprites, you know, the little biker sprites, but
yeah, pretty great. You should get it.
Oh, well, okay. I'm leaving Target now. Anyway, thank you folks for listening, and Drew and I will be back soon.